on the line this morning, but I just wanted to introduce who is in the room with us this morning here in Ann Arbor. So it's myself, of course. We have Tao and Carol Farver, two of our thoracic consultants here. We have Lawrence Brisky, our fellow, who is actually going to be presenting one of our articles today, and Ivana, who is an observer from Serbia, who's with us for the next few months, and we're happy to have her here. So we'll just go ahead and get started here. Thank you all for calling in today or listening. This is rescheduled. This is a rescheduled journal club from actually the end of January. So today's journal club comprises the December 2019 articles. It wasn't a tremendous month as far as the number of publications that might be relevant to the interest of this group. There were 13 articles that mainly comprised articles in neoplastic lung disease. I'd like to take a moment before we get started on the discussion articles to look at some of the articles that I summarized in articles for notation. I have a bit of buyer's remorse for those articles that I selected as the discussion articles, and I think that there are some that are worth mentioning that we're not going to discuss in detail. So looking at the articles for notation, the first one at the top of the list actually comes from our colleagues in Mayo. Mayo was featured in three of the publications in December, actually. This was loss of succinate dehydrogenase B immunohistochemical expression distinguishes pulmonary chondromas from hamartomas. In this study, six pulmonary chondromas and 33 cases of pulmonary hamartoma were looked at for their immunohistochemical expression of succinate dehydrogenase B. Of those six pulmonary chondromas, four patients had established clinical diagnoses of Carney's triad. Five of those six cases of pulmonary chondromas showed loss of cytoplasmic succinate dehydrogenase expression, and of those, 100% were the Carney triad patients. So I think that this is just on a marker. Certainly it's on Mayo's radar, but one to be familiar with in that it may be helpful in the differential diagnosis of chondroma versus pulmonary hamartoma. I think, in my opinion, probably when that's a question on small biopsy, and potentially I could see it being useful if you're if you're struggling between is this non-neoplastic bronchial cartilage that I'm looking at, or could this actually represent the neoplasm in a small sample. So this is something just to have on your radar for now. I don't believe that we have this at Michigan currently. The next one I want to briefly mention is actually the
Christine, can I ask a question about
that? Yes, please.
Does that succinate dehydrogenase deficiency also occur in chondromas of bone?
The answer is I don't know. Does anyone on the call know about that? Yeah, I'm afraid I don't know, Tom. All right, so the next article in notations that I think worth just briefly mentioning would be the impact of delayed fixation and decalcification on PD-L1 expression, a comparison of two clones. While PD-L1 testing is not recommended on decal specimens, sometimes that's all we have to go from. So I think that this, you know, kind of study that actually is performed on placental and tumor tissues is interesting in that they used very pre-analytic conditions for amount of fixation and types of decalcifiers and looked at two antibodies, 22C3 and E1L3N. And so that's just something to be aware of, perhaps in your own laboratories. Moving on, I really actually enjoyed this article. Again, a collaboration between a group in Hungary and the Mayo Clinic Jacksonville, which is correlation between immunohistochemistry and Richter fish amplification in small cell lung carcinomas. They looked at 100 cases of small cell carcinoma, and in those, they looked at Richter amplification by fish, and that was detected in 15% of cases. Then they looked at the immunohistochemical expression for Richter, which was shown to have good sensitivity and pretty good specificity for Richter with 93% sensitivity and 73% specificity for overexpression. And really, this could be a useful marker when we're talking about patients who may benefit from mTORC inhibitor therapy. We're not performing Richter here, but I think that this is something that we could be asked to do in the future, and I think for that reason, this is something to be aware of. Finally, just a brief mention on a letter to the editor, which is comes out of UCSF, and actually the first author is going to be our fellow next year, Rachel Fells Elliott. We're looking forward to having her. But this is entitled Giant Cell Interstitial Pneumonia Secondary to Cobalt Exposure from E-Cigarette Use. I thought this was really interesting in that while it's just a letter to the editor, it's a case study of a 49-year-old woman who presents with clinical interstitial lung disease and central lobular nodules, goes on to have a lung wedge biopsy, which was consistent, they felt, with giant cell interstitial pneumonia. They tested the liquid from her e-cigarette, marijuana e-cigarette that she used, and that was shown to contain cobalt. They also tested her lung tissue, and that failed to show cobalt. But I just wonder if this is another pattern of histology that may be seen in those patients who present with clinical interstitial lung disease and are marijuana e-cigarette users. And I don't know if anyone else has observed this pattern or made this correlation. I certainly haven't, though I freely admit that I have not had much experience in saying that I think that some lung changes are attributable to marijuana e-cigarette use. So has anyone else seen that just or noticed that?
Just a question there. Did they look at, you know, like a sample of 50 other e-cigarettes to see if there was cobalt in them?
No, this was purely a case report. But I think that they were just trying to propose that, you know, this is the explanation for the histology. But when you look at the results from their mass spec, they had a whole bunch of heavy metals in there. So, once again, poorly regulated and full of heavy metals. It's as though you need another reason not to smoke marijuana e-cigarettes.
Hey, Tom.
And was it just the marijuana ones, or is it the ones that are nicotine?
I don't know. This lady only used, they even had exactly what she used. She used the Zen Pen personal vaporizer. So I don't know. They haven't gone on to test other ones, but I think it would be really interesting. And actually, in their article, they hypothesized that maybe because you have to heat the marijuana liquid to a higher temperature than the e-cigarette liquid, that perhaps those coils, that's where the cobalt is coming from, but I have no idea. I mean, that was just their hypothesis. Anyone else? Okay.
Well, I like the name Zen 10. That's a good name.
I know. All of them have great names. Anyhow, well, thanks so much for entertaining me and talking about those articles for notation. We're now going to move on to our first discussion article, which is actually prepared by Dr. Lawrence Brisky, who is our thoracic fellow this year.
Okay, thank you, Christine. So the first article for discussion was published in Lung Cancer by a group from Japan, looking at loss of expression of SWI/SNF in non-small cell lung cancer. So as you all know, the switch sucrose non-fermentable or SWI/SNF complex is a large complex that plays an important role and chromatin remodeling and therefore gene expression and regulation. There are several subunits in this complex, which include, among others, SMARCB1, SMARCA4, SMARCA2, ARID1A, and ARID1B. Each of these subunits have alternate names, so on the summary page, I've included a reference for you to look at if you care. But I'll just briefly mention that the term BAF or BAF is synonymous with SWI/SNF. And the authors use this term interchangeably with SWI/SNF, so that's why I mention it. As you all know, inactivation mutations in several of these subunits have been implicated in various neoplasms, including a significant proportion of non-small cell lung cancer. So the objectives of this study were to examine the clinical pathologic features, PD-L1 immunohistochemical expression, and tumor mutation burden in non-small cell lung carcinoma with respect to loss of immunohistochemical expression of specific SWI/SNF proteins, namely SMARC-A4, SMARC-A2, ARID-1A, and ARID-1B. So as we go through, I'll be mentioning several figures and tables that are in the paper, but I'll also be referring to supplemental data, which if you want to review, you can find by going to the very end of the article. Just before the references, there's a hyperlink that you can click on. The authors reviewed a total of 1,013 cases of non-small cell lung carcinoma resected from one institution between May of 2010 and March of 2015. These included 744 cases of adenocarcinoma, 254 cases of squamous cell carcinoma, and 15 others, which were comprised of 7 adenosquames, 7 large cell carcinomas, and 1 pleomorphic carcinoma. For each case, the authors reviewed age, sex, smoking history, medical history, invasive tumor size, pleural invasion, vascular invasion, intrapulmonary metastasis, lymphatic permeation, lymph node metastasis, stage, tumor morphology, and EGFR mutation status. They also looked at overall survival and recurrence-free survival. They constructed tissue microarrays from the tumors and analyzed them by immunohistochemistry. For the SWI-SNP proteins, staining was interpreted as being either lost or intact. Loss of reactivity was defined as complete absence of nuclear staining. If you turn to page 3 of the article, you'll see figure 1, where they have examples of intact and lost expression of all 4 subunits with positive internal control. For PD-L1 immunohistochemistry, they used the DACO-22C3 clone, and they evaluated the proportion of viable tumor cells exhibiting membranous staining of any intensity. PD-L1 was reported as being either less than 1% or greater than or equal to 1%, and in the latter case as being less than 50% or greater than or equal to 50%. In addition to the immunohistochemistry, they also performed whole exome sequencing on 10 cases. Why 10 cases? Well, because these were part of a larger study for which they had the appropriate informed consent. So the whole exome sequencing data was then used to calculate tumor mutation burden, defined as the total number of non-synonymous somatic mutations present in a baseline tumor sample. So for the immunohistochemistry, FAF loss was observed in 5.4% of cases overall. These included 5.5% of the adenocarcinomas and 4.7% of the squamous cell carcinomas. If you refer to page 4 of the article, you'll find table 1, which has a more specific breakdown of all 4 subunits. But basically, I'll just point out that SMARC-A4 loss and SMARC-A2 loss were more common in adenocarcinoma relative to squamous cell carcinoma, whereas ARID-1A loss and ARID-1B loss were more common in squamous cell carcinoma relative to adenocarcinoma. Concurrent loss of expression of 2 or more subunits was observed in only 7 cases, so less than 1%. If you're interested in learning more about those 7 cases, you can refer to supplemental table 2. At the bottom of page 4, you'll find table 2, which I've summarized on the review sheet. But basically, compared to the BAF intact cases, BAF loss was significantly associated with the following: younger age, male sex, smoking history, pulmonary emphysema, larger invasive tumor size, pleural invasion, vascular invasion, solid predominant histologic subtype, and absence of a lipidic growth component. While all of these were statistically significant, some of them may not be clinically significant. For example, younger age, if you look at the median and range for the two groups, I would argue that there's not much of a clinical difference there. Some things have a much more clinical significance, such as solid predominant histologic subtype, 71% versus 40%. If you go to the next page, on page 5 of the article, you'll see figure 2, which has 4 Kaplan-Meier curves looking at overall survival and recurrence-free survival in all cases and also in patients with stage 1 disease. For all cases, BAP loss was associated with a shorter overall survival, but there was no difference in recurrence-free survival between BAF loss and BAF intact. For stage 1 disease, BAF loss was associated with both shorter overall survival and recurrence-free survival. For patients with stage 2 disease, stage 3 disease, or stage 4 disease, there was no difference in overall survival or recurrence-free survival. And if you're interested in seeing the Kaplan-Meier curves for those, they're available in supplemental figure 1. Now, these Kaplan-Meier curves are based on univariate analysis. The authors also performed multivariate analysis, controlling for all the clinical pathologic features that I mentioned previously. When multivariate analysis was performed, there was no difference in overall survival or recurrence-free survival between the BAF loss group and the BAF intact group for patients with stage 1 disease. Also on page 5, you'll see table 3, which shows that there was a higher proportion of PD-L1 staining of 1% or greater in the BAF loss group, 42% versus 26% for BAF intact. There was no difference in the proportion of PD-L1 staining of 50% or greater between the two groups. Also on page 5, you'll see a scatter plot for the whole exome sequencing cohort, and that shows that the tumor mutation burden was significantly higher in tumors with BAF loss, with a median of 437 mutations per whole exome, compared to the BAF intact group, which had a median of 113 mutations per whole exome. But the caveat there, obviously, there was only 10 cases, so not very many cases. And also, if you look at the scatter plot, two of the BAF intact had values close to the median for the BAF loss. So bottom line is there's not a lot of statistical power in this part of the study. Overall, the authors concluded, as explicitly stated in their title, that loss of expression of SWI/SNF and non-small cell lung carcinoma is associated with aggressive clinical pathologic features, PD-L1 positive status, and high tumor mutation burden. What are the take-home messages? Well, number one, loss of SWI/SNF occurs in only a small minority of non-small cell lung carcinoma, about 5 to 6%. That being said, it may be more commonly seen in more poorly differentiated tumors, specifically with solid phenotype. But should we be routinely testing for this? Diagnostically, these are all conventional non-small cell lung carcinomas, so this information is not required for diagnosis. The authors argue that this information may provide some prognostic value, but as evidenced by their multivariate analysis, this information in and of itself is not an independent prognostic factor, so it's debatable how much value it really adds. And therapeutically, this information is not used in treatment strategies, and it's uncertain if it would impact future treatment strategies. So with that, be happy to entertain any questions or comments before moving on to the next article.
Yeah, this is Colby. I have a question, and that comes from my ignorance. What's the soft tissue tumor that the soft tissue people are excited about, the rhabdoid tumor? What is are they missing one of these SMARC genes, but it's a different one than this?
It's SMARC B1 or INA1, I believe.
Okay.
Which is different than the ones tested for in this particular study.
So none of these cases look like a rhabdoid tumor?
No, these all look like conventional non-small cell carcinoma. These are not at all related to the what's been described as SMARC A4 deficient sarcomatoid tumor of the lung either.
Okay, thank you, Lawrence. You navigated that question far better than I could have. So thank you. All right, so next article is the remainder are going to be presented by myself. Next one I selected was the diagnostic value of biopsy sampling in predicting histology in patients with diffuse malignant pleural mesothelioma. This study really comes out of the Brigham and Women's Hospital, where they look to assess the concordance between and prognostic value of paired specimens that included the biopsy material, the initial biopsy material from a patient, and their subsequent surgical resection specimen. They looked at the histologic subtype, but in that they also looked at patient characteristics and outcomes. They also correlated concordance and prognostic value with the number and volume of the initial biopsies. So this was a retrospective review that occurred over an 18-year period, which I already mentioned. They looked at patient characteristics, histologic subtypes, and outcomes. The pathology slides, let me go back. So the inclusion criteria was really simple. It was simply that a patient have both biopsy and surgical resection material available for review. The slides were reviewed by two of three pathologists that were on this study, and when they couldn't agree on the subtype, they performed a consensus review. They classified tumors as epithelioid, sarcomatoid, or biphasic. Although not stated, I suspect that desmoplastic was nestled under the sarcomatoid subtype. And for a diagnosis of biphasic, they required 10% of each component, epithelioid and sarcomatoid. So they had a massive number of cases, in my opinion, that were paired specimens. In this study, they had 759 patients who met the inclusion criteria. If you want to look at Table 1, this details the clinical characteristics of these patients. But in brief, their cohort was comprised of 78% males with a median age of 61 years, and the age range from 18 to 86 years. The type of biopsy, the initial biopsy, was by far thoracoscopic biopsies. Of those 759, 728 were thoracoscopic, with a small minority being core needle biopsy. I was impressed by the number of extrapleural pneumonectomies that were in this study, with 519 and extrapleural pneumonectomies and 240 pleurectomies and decortications. So I think that Table 2 really nicely summarizes a lot of their the relationship between the histologic types in the initial biopsy and the surgical resection. Now, while they use concordance and discordance, I have a hard time, I think, just from my perspective. It's not really discordant. I think that they did a great job giving to mesothelioma in this case, but again, they're just looking at how correct the concordance of that initial biopsy with the subsequent resection. So overall, the concordance between initial and resection typing was 81.6%. The highest concordance was seen in those cases that were initially diagnosed as a biphasic type. That comprised 86% concordance, and there was 80% concordance with the diagnosis of epithelioid type and sarcomatoid types. So looking at kind of Table 2, initial biopsy, 575 cases were called epithelioid mesothelioma. At resection, that number was 483. So of those cases that were reclassified or further classified, I should say, on resection, all of those were found later to be biphasic mesothelioma. None were initially diagnosed as epithelioid mesothelioma and later diagnosed as sarcomatoid mesothelioma. As I already mentioned, biphasic type, the initial biopsy was 140, and at resection, 243 cases were classified as biphasic mesothelioma. So really that group increased by those cases of epithelioid mesothelioma later classified as biphasic, and sarcomatoid carcinomas later found to be biphasic as well. They had 8 cases that they called indeterminate on initial biopsy. They don't explain as to why those cases were considered indeterminate, so I can't tell you any more about that. To further summarize, 19% of both epithelioid and sarcomatoid initial biopsies subsequently were classified as biphasic mesothelioma. Biphasic mesothelioma, only a small percentage were later classified as epithelioid or sarcomatoid. So they said that once they saw the entire specimen, although on biopsy, both types were observed, really a single subtype predominated, and that was why they reclassified those. So that's really the details of the concordance. Their next objective, as I already mentioned, was looking at the number of blocks and the volume of tissue, and did that somehow impact the concordance. They found a small but statistically significant difference in the number of blocks examined in the initial biopsy and the concordance. So those cases that were concordant were found to have at least three paraffin and tissue blocks available to look at for at the time of biopsy. So that was kind of for those thoracic, maybe three samples or at least three blocks worth of tissue. Those that were called discordant had less than three blocks. When more than nine blocks were examined, which occurred in 23 cases, so this is nine blocks of biopsies, there was 100% concordance. So if your surgeon, I suppose, asks how many, you could say nine, but it depends on how important that is. There was no significant difference in the volume of tissue examined and the diagnostic accuracy. They were actually looking at tissue volume, so it's really the number of blocks. Perhaps most importantly, what are the independent predictors of survival? Well, those are age, clinical stage, and the histology and the resection specimen. And I think that probably the most powerful figure, the most informative for me at least, was if you look at figure 2C, this figure comprises those patients, those 112 patients are really seen here, if you think about it that way. The upper curve is the survival for patients with epithelioid mesothelioma at resection, and then the lower curve is biopsied as epithelioid mesothelioma and then later reclassified as biphasic. So I hope that makes sense, just showing that for those patients that are reclassified there or later, they have a much worse survival, and perhaps that's the most meaning that can be taken away from this paper, at least in my opinion, about for those patients. So the take-home message, there's good concordance, in my opinion, between initial biopsy and subsequent resection, with most cases being reclassified to biphasic mesothelioma, with the recognition of a second subtype at resection. Perhaps not surprisingly, we're better at making the diagnosis when we have more tissue to review. And as I already alluded to, I think that this only becomes most meaningful when you think about those patients that perhaps carried a diagnosis of epithelioid mesothelioma on biopsy and were later found to have biphasic mesothelioma. And kind of the magic number for blocks, if you're really worried about your concordance, is the number three. So those were my take-homes from this paper. Does anyone have any comments?
I have a question. How many resections of mesothelioma do you or anybody else on the phone call see these days?
Zero. I feel like I don't see any. I mean, we'll see some decortications, but certainly during my time here at Michigan, so during 6 years, I've never seen an extrapleural pneumonectomy. How about anyone else? Carol, what did you see, your experience at Cleveland?
We had a lot of extrapleural pneumonectomies until about 2 years ago, and then they became more decortication. I have not seen an extrapleural pneumonectomy in probably the last 2 or 3 years.
Yeah.
My understanding was that in Boston, if you had a pure sarcomatoid one, they wouldn't take you to resection, but I guess they did, huh?
This data was from 2006, so I don't know how their practices changed after that, I wonder. But yeah, I understood the same.
If you're not going to do surgery on a sarcomatoid meso or one that has any sarcomatoid histology, then it would make sense to have a big biopsy. But if you're going to do the resection, no matter what the biopsy shows, the only purpose of the biopsy then is for prognosis. But you're going to use your resection specimen for prognosis anyway.
Right. I agree completely. Carol, do you have any comments?
I agree.
Yeah.
This is an unbelievable number of cases. I mean, can you imagine doing that many surgeries on a disease? And then you look at the survival curves and you say, okay, Mr. Jones, you know, you've gone from a really bad survival to just a bad survival.
I know. That's exactly what we're talking about, Munch, but I suppose I shouldn't be too critical that, you know, may matter. So,
well, it's obviously significant, so it does matter a little bit.
Yep. So, yeah, they had, an astounding number here. Cool.
Having trained there in the 90s, I can remember doing a lot of extrapleural pneumonectomies with David Sugarbaker. So
yeah.
I think that number correlates with reality.
Wow. Cool. Well, thank
you
so much.
Well, the thing about Sugarbaker is at least he doesn't have a lot of patients in his follow-up clinics.
Oh, my goodness. All right. So the next article for discussion, these next two I think will be pretty brief, to be quite honest. The next paper comes out of the Quebec Heart and Lung Institute. They're looking at the impact of specimen characteristics on PD-L1 testing in non-small cell lung cancer, validation of the IASLC PD-L1 testing recommendations. And so they really decided to look at this in the context of the recommendation that there should be no testing on tumors with a cellularity less than 100 cells and tissue blocks older than 3 years, and the author's rationale for this or why they wanted to look at this is they felt that this was data extrapolated from other immunohistochemistry stains and studies, and really at this point they felt that the PD-L1 recommendations were not founded. So their goal was to evaluate the impact of suboptimal specimen characteristics, that is, those with fewer than 100 tumor cells and blocks older than 3 years, and they also decided they wanted to look at cytologic cell blocks and see the impact on PD-L1 testing results using the 22C3 antibody. This was a retrospective study conducted at their institution, which represented kind of a referral center for PD-L1 testing. The inclusion criteria was pretty simple in that the patient needed to carry a diagnosis of non-small cell lung carcinoma. They verified that diagnosis by histology, and these were non-decalcified specimens. PD-L1 expression was scored as less than 1 to 49%, and greater than 50%. So they had about 1,200 cases that met inclusion criteria, and this is detailed in Table 1 if you want to take a look at the clinical and pathologic characteristics of their cohort. Which details the sites sampled, and the types of cancer. Notably, they had 444 specimens that had at least one characteristic for which PD-L1 testing was not recommended. This included 40 blocks older than 3 years, and they actually stratified this this data by the age of the blocks. You can see that they looked at they have the number of blocks that were less than 1 month old, those that were 1 to 12 months, 12 to 36 months, and older than 36 months. They also had 96 blocks with 1 to 100 tumor cells, and they had 355 cytology specimens. So if you want to look at Table 2, this, I think, really is the best look at their tumor proportion score data. So you can see that there's a decrease in antigenicity over time. And I thought it was interesting that this really particularly occurred after 1 year. You know, while we're talking about this three-year cutoff, really after 1 year, you start to see a big drop and a far larger and an increase in those cases that show less than 1% staining or, 1 to 49% staining. So I think that this, for me, was probably the most impressive takeaway from this paper. They found that specimens with fewer than 100 tumor cells was associated with lower PD-L1 expression, perhaps not surprising since there can be significant intratumoral heterogeneity in these tumors, and this just may account for that. So low tumor cellularity does affect PD-L1, as we would anticipate. And they found no significant association between PD-L1 expression and specimen type, so thereby showing that cytology cell blocks are good for PD-L1 testing. Just kind of an ancillary secondary finding that they had, lymph node and distant metastases showed higher expression of PD-L1 when compared to the primary tumor. So I think that the take-home points here are from from this study are that the testing recommendations for specimens older than 3 years and those comprised of fewer than 100 tumor cells have been validated. And this study supports the use of cell blocks for PD-L1 testing. Of course, if no other specimen is available, testing may be performed on these, quote, suboptimal specimens with acknowledgement that these patients are more likely to have a negative result. And you know, I think that for me at least, it may cause individuals to relook at, is it 3 years or is it after 1 year, you know, that suboptimal time, or where you might be adding a disclaimer or that sort of thing for blocks older than a year. And that's really it for this paper, if there are any comments.
Yeah, this is Colby again. I haven't done this. So, number one, do you know how they count the number of of cells? Is that just an estimate, or do they actually count them analytically?
I don't know how they count. They don't say it here. Does anyone happen to know? Is it the eyeball method, the scientific eyeball method? Yeah, I don't know, because they don't mention it here, Tom. Mm-hmm.
I mean, one way to get around that is to just do two levels. You know, if you have one level that has 50 cells, you could do a deeper level with another 50 cells. I'm not involved in the PDL testing at all, so I have no idea what the logistics of it are. But I mean, you could easily enough increase your cell number just by doing levels.
Yeah, I don't know, and I don't know because I'm not part of, we have a IHC kind of group here at Michigan, and I'm not part of that group.
I bet you're glad of that.
I am glad of that. Don't tell anyone. We are being recorded. All right. Let's move on to the last paper that, once again, because of the fixation on histologic subtype, I couldn't resist. This is a paper out of Japan with frequent appearance of club cell or Clarasil-like cells as a histologic marker of ALK-positive lung adenocarcinoma. To be honest, I struggled a little bit in trying to write this sentence of the purpose, because I think that I just felt like they wanted to do a study on their ALK positive lung cancers and they needed to pull something out from it. So it looks like they wanted to report some unique findings in their ALK positive lung cancers, and they decided that would be the histologic features of papillary adenocarcinoma and kind of the cytology, the unique cytology in those cancers. So first we need to define how they define the club cell-like cells. These are cancer cells exhibiting eosinophilic cytoplasmic projections or snouts at the apical portion of their surface in the papillary patterns of adenocarcinoma. So and you can look at figure 1 for a representative image of that. So what they did is analyze the histologic patterns of 18 ALK-positive lung adenocarcinomas compared to 62 control tumors. These were comprised of 22 EGFR-positive adenocarcinomas and 40 ALK and EGFR-negative adenocarcinomas. Of course, then they moved on to assess the presence of these club cell-like cells in the papillary portions of the adenocarcinomas. And then, you know, they kind of did this little immunohistochemistry on their cases of ALK-positive lung adenocarcinomas as well, just looking for surfactant production. So for the results, you can look at table 2, which shows the predominant histologic patterns. The ALK-positive tumors were virtually the only ones that showed the solid signet ring cell and mucinous cribriform patterns. They wanted to highlight that here, since they said that those are the patterns that are most frequently described in the setting of ALK-positive adenocarcinomas. They then moved on to specifically look at the papillary, the presence of the papillary pattern in all adenocarcinomas, divided, of course, by ALK-positive, EGFR-positive, and ALK and EGFR-negative. Of all the cancer cases looked at, 95% of all cases showed papillary pattern of adenocarcinoma, and this pattern was more common in the EGFR and ALK and EGFR negative cases than in ALK positive. Having said that, 83% of ALK positive cases showed papillary pattern somewhere in the tumor, although that was not the predominant pattern in the majority of cases. Only in 5 of those 18 cases was papillary the predominant pattern. They also looked at the micropapillary pattern, which was most commonly seen in the ALK-positive cases, followed by EGFR, and then finally the ALK and EGFR-negative cases. Then they looked, this is illustrated in Table 4, they looked at the presence of the club cell-like cells, and those were seen with greater frequency in the ALK-positive cases, although they were observed in other cases as well, so just higher frequency. So I guess the take-home message from this is in the absence of solid or signet ring cell and mucinous cribriform patterns, the presence of club cell-like cells in papillary arrangement may be a histologic clue that you are dealing with an ALK-positive lung adenocarcinoma. As an editorial comment, I have never found that my observation of any predominant pattern was ever a surrogate for molecular testing, but this is just one more thing for us to worry about, I suppose. So if there are any comments on this,
I'm not sure I'm going to join that club.
I'm not in that club, so that's okay.
That's a nice picture.
It is. So, all right. Well, thanks, everyone, for calling in today and the discussion. As always, it's very much appreciated.
Thank you, Christine.
Thanks.
Thank you. Have a good
thanks.
Day.
You too. Signing off.
Thanks.
Thank you. Please stand by.